morning, Chair.
Morning. I think we are left with 1 minute before we start. Let me start by welcoming the Deputy Minister, John Jeffrey, who will be leading us with the first item on the remuneration of judges and then of magistrates. And then thereafter we will move to the traditional court bill, and then we will end with the land court bill. That is the order for today. Over to you, Honorable John Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members. The judiciary and the independent constitutional institutions are entitled to such remuneration, salaries, allowances, and benefits as determined
Recording
by
in progress.
President from time to time by notice in the Gazette after taking into consideration the recommendations of the Independent Commission for the Remuneration of Public Office Bearers. The notice by the President must be submitted to Parliament for approval or disapproval, whether in whole or in part, and that is what effectively you're being asked for today. On behalf of the Office of the President, I present the determination by the President of the remuneration for judges and magistrates. So, Chair, while it's two separate notices, it's effectively the same issue. The determined by the President is with effect from the 1st of April 2021, that's last year, for the 2021-22 financial year. The Independent Commission gazetted its report on the remuneration of all office bearers only on the 30th of March 2022 in terms of the Act. So that's why usually we do this before the end of the financial year. Unfortunately, the Commission was late. The Commission, after having considered, amongst others, the submissions from the various stakeholders, the fiscal condition of the state's wage bill, and the impact of the salary increment of the public office bearers on the fiscus and the general economic status of the country as affected by the COVID pandemic and the affordability of the fiscus, recommended a 3% salary increment to the President and all public office bearers for the 2021-22 financial year with effect from the 1st of April 2021. On the 26th of May this year, the President, after having considered the gazetted report of the IRC, submitted his determination in respect of the remuneration of judges and magistrates to both Houses of Parliament. Effectively, the President agreed with the recommendations of the IRC and is intending to determine a 3% wage salary increase across the board for all ranks of judges and magistrates, subject to the approval of Parliament. And then, as you know, on the 30th of May, the Speaker referred the determination for the judges and magistrates to your portfolio committee. In terms of the report of the Remuneration Committee, the judges submitted that their salaries diminished due to the below inflation or no increases of salaries, and referred the IRC to Section 176(3) of the Constitution, which provides that salaries, allowances, and benefits of the judges may not be reduced. They raised a concern that their salaries were eroded, they felt, by over 20% during the past 5 years. They further submit that the erosion is unconstitutional. So just drawing that to your attention, they proposed that the IRC should consider consider the salaries of judges separately from other political office bearers, and they wanted a cost of living allowance. And that the IRC should consider implementing progressive steps aimed at addressing the 20% deficit and grant an adjustment which is above the CPI or no less than 8%. But according to the report of the IRC, the Lower Court Remuneration Committee submitted on behalf of the magistrates that the remuneration levels have consistently been reduced over the past 11 years, and they also recommended a cost of living adjustment. And they, in fact, wanted a cost of living adjustment of 5.3%. So it's basically recommended that the Portfolio Committee consider and approve the notices by the President and the 3% increase for all ranks of judges and magistrates with effect from the 1st of April 2021. So Chair, that is the presentation, the input.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, for the presentation. Members, any comments, questions? Honorable Horn and Honorable Jelle, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to all colleagues and also specifically to the Deputy Minister. Yes, Chair, maybe in response to the submissions by the judiciary, as just now put on the table by the Minister, the Deputy Minister, I would want to say that it is indeed a worry. It is a I want to say, a global principle or element of true independence of the judiciary that the remuneration of members of the judiciary cannot be diminished. However, I want to say that similar to any statutory interpretation with which our members of the judiciary is tasked from day to day, the submissions around this, of course, has to be considered within the current context in which we operate, and if the context indicate unmanageable pressure on the public purse, and if all others who are dependent on their remuneration from the public purse, as well as specifically dependent on their remuneration as part of the processes followed by the Independent Commission, is treated in a similar way, then of course the context would indicate that it is not necessarily aimed at the judiciary. Having said that, all of us who are committed to the independence of our judiciary must, in the same vein or at the same time, be very worried about the risks associated with our inability to ensure that members of the judiciary receive proper increases, because it is quite clear that there are some very specific risks involved in that situation, and I would think that whilst we in the current context ultimately might be forced to confirm the proposals as sent through first by the Independent Commission and then by the President, I think one proviso must be added, and that is that ultimately this is now becoming a bit of a trend, and in that sense it is something that must be arrested before it poses very very material risks to the independence of our judiciary. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn, Honorable Chele.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues, and also good morning to our Deputy Minister. Chairperson, I wouldn't agree more with Honorable Horn, repeating word by word will be really wasting time. I'm looking at this presentation and the recommendations of the independent and the risk associated. Those are the issues that one, when was reading here, was looking into, and also worried that indeed it is important to consider this and endorse it in one way or the other, Chair. Because the only thing that I saw when I was reading this presentation, it was the concerns of the minister, the treasury, minister of finance. But indeed, we cannot overlook the issue of the risk that comes with not endorsing this. Without waste of time, Chair, let me just say I agree with Honorable Khan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jale. Is there anyone who would want to speak or to disagree with the two speakers that have spoken in support of us agreeing to the recommendation? I see none. The two recommendations with respect to the judges and the magistrates are agreed to. Tomorrow we would adopt a report that will be sent to the House for approval. Thank you very much, members. Oh, the report is ready. Can we allow some time for members to read the report before we adopt it? Because I'm informed that the legal advisor is attending the Portfolio Committee on Transport, and she will be joining us at 10 o'clock. Can I propose that we have 10 minutes to go through the report, and then thereafter we will consider the report. Is that in order, members?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just maybe to assist, just a question to the committee section. Is this the same, obviously with a different amount, is this the same wording as previous reports on judges and magistrates salary increases? This one obviously on the screen is judges, but just is there any difference from what was done? Well, last year the judges didn't get any increase. I mean, 2019-20. Is this wording any different? Through you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramano.
Good morning, Chair. The wording remains the same.
Yeah, we have a consistent template here, Deputy Minister.
No, that was just to try and assist committee members that okay, this is something you've looked at before, but I'm not influencing you. Thanks.
No, thank you very much. Now let's stick to the time that we have agreed to, because at any rate, the next item on the agenda should start at 10. So we still do have time. So can we start at 10:02 or 5:02? Because I mean, there's nothing more. Let's start at 5:02.
Agreed.
Committee Secretary, can you flag the report? A report of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services on the draft notice and schedule determining the rate with effect from the 1st of April 2021 at which salaries, allowances and benefits are payable to Constitutional Court judges and judges annually dated 7 June 2022. The report is taken as read. Is there any mover for the report to be adopted?
Chair Steve here.
Honorable Steve Swart.
I just wanted to check right at the end it refers to notice and schedule, it doesn't refer to draft again. Is it necessary to put the word in draft again, or is it already captured? But subject to that, I move that it be accepted. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson, would you deal with that issue of the draft? Can you delete it?
Sorry, I was just trying to find my thing. No, the draft schedule, I think, is what was referred. I'll just check the referral and make sure that it's consistent with the referral.
Are you satisfied, Honourable Swart?
Yes, Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much. With that correction, is there a mover for the adoption of the report as corrected?
Swart moves, Chair.
Honourable Swart moves. Is there a seconder? Is there a seconder, member?
You heard Griffin second, Chair?
Honourable Newport, Johan seconds. Is there anyone who objects? None. No objection. The report is agreed to. The next report. This one also will be taken as read. Report of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services on the draft notice and schedule determining the rate with effect from the 1st of April 2021, at which salaries, allowances, and benefits are payable to magistrates annually for approval by Parliament in terms of Section 10, Subsection 3 of the Magistrate Act of 1993, Act Number 90 of 1993. Dated 7 June 2022. Let me start with corrections. Are there any corrections to the report? No correction. Is there a mover for the adoption of the report?
Chair, I move for the adoption of the report with all the.
Honourable Masego Jelle moves for the adoption of the report. Any seconder?
Swart seconds, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable Swart seconds. Any objections? No objection. The report is agreed to. The report will be transmitted to the National Assembly. It will be debated in due course. I think the programming committee that will sit on Thursday will guide us as to when the report would be debated and approved by the House. Thank you very much. Is the advisor, the parliamentary legal advisor present now?
Yes, she is present.
Okay. Welcome. What is the name?
It's Ms. Pumelele Ngema.
Welcome, Ms. Ngema, again. Can you take us through the legal opinion? We are now members dealing with a traditional court bill.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Greetings to yourself and greetings to the members and everyone on the platform. I appreciate the indulgence and the opportunity for the committee to have allowed me to come join the meeting at 10 instead of when the committee had started. Thank you so much, Chairperson, and to all the members for that. I will try and fly to the presentation, trusting that I've been given the right to do so. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
I'm trusting, Chairperson, as it appears on my side, it is also appearing on the side of the members.
Yes, it does.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Basically, what we are dealing with as right now, Chairperson, is the request of the committee, which was asked and given to us sometime last year, 2021, Chairperson, where the committee took a decision to request that an external senior counsel present a legal opinion on the constitutionality of the Traditional Courts Bill, which is a bill that has been considered by both houses of parliament, being the National Assembly initially, and resulted in a B version, and then it was transcribed and transferred to the next house, the National Council of Provinces, which also made its own amendments and resulted in a D version called Traditional Courts Bill 1, 2017. The opinion from Advocate Masuri Chaperson was received on the 12th of October 2021, and there are various issues that he spoke to as raised in his opinion and raised by the question of the members when it was instructing and guiding his opinion. He spoke to the following summarized topic, Chaperson. Does the bill embody the principles of traditional court system as it stands? What are the implications of Section 34 of the Constitution on the Traditional Courts Bill itself? And are these courts, the traditional courts, a court under Chapter 8 and Section 166E of the Constitution, or are they the second part which appears in Section 34, being the appropriate place for a fair public hearing to resolve disputes as either an independent tribunal or an independent forum? If they are courts within the justice system under Chapter 8 of the Constitution, within the judicial system, what becomes of the appointment processes set out in Section 174 of the Constitution? His opinion goes into details trying to unpack this question and the issues. He further asked, what about the principles of separation of powers and the independence that is inherent and granted to courts' powers and required for the judicial system? Which he argues, if one considers the manner that it is currently of the bill, may seem inconsistent in respect of traditional courts. He further takes the committee to the implications of Chapter 12 of the Constitution and tries to explain it as well, how the traditional authority and traditional leadership is recognized under Chapter 12, which in his arguments, he further alludes that the recognition under Chapter 12 does not appear to include and be the recognition and the rationalization that's required of the traditional courts. He therefore, I will give a summary on how he brings about that argument. He therefore then asks if traditional authorities, as they are recognized under Chapter 12 of the Constitution, are they extended the power and the requirements, do they meet them, of Chapter 8 for courts of justice? And what is the distinction between the Chapter 8 courts and what is envisaged of Section 34 courts, independent tribunals, independent and impartial tribunals, or independent and impartial forums as well? He further then unpacks, Chaperson, the details of the Constitution as our supreme law in relation to traditional courts. He has explained, Chaperson, that under Chapter 12, in his legal view and the way he says it, Section 211 deals with the institution of traditional authorities. And traditional authority in its entirety is recognized, and its status and role of traditional leadership according to customary law is further recognized. But at all times, when there are repeal or reenactment or review or rationalization of legislation that speaks to traditional courts or traditional authorities, it has to be aligned and in accordance with the Constitution. So he asked the question, what does then Chapter 12 read under Section 211 mean? And if we read Section 211 of the Constitution, does it speak to Schedule 6, Item 16 of the Constitution, where this provision, Schedule 6, Item 16 of the Constitution, it speaks to transitional arrangements relating to all courts of the land. He does make a specific mention that under Schedule 6, Item 16, traditional courts are mentioned as courts existing and continue as such at the commencement of the final constitution. He unpacks what these two provisions mean. The members would recall that at earlier times and in the previous sessions, which was as this bill stems from 2017, it may involve members that come from the previous parliament and the members that have joined this current parliament. What the advocate points out is that the section 211 recognition does not include the recognition of traditional courts in light of what Schedule 16, in light of what Schedule 6, Item 16 is legislating upon and the manner in which it is legislated as. He further points out that for the traditional authority recognized under Section 211, all these, including the traditional court, are subjected to three other factors to find and promote their existence and continuity. Number one, subjected to any amendment or repeal of the legislation that gives their existence or continuity that was applicable in light of the customary law. Such changes must at all times be consistent with the Constitution. Thirdly, as a structure of the institution recognized with its status and role as a traditional leadership, at all times, such structures must be subjected to the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. He does point out that there is an entanglement or a situation that is created that requires that distinctions be made between traditional authority as recognized under Chapter 12, which in light of the constitutional principles, including the principles of independence for the court, the principle of separation of powers, the courts as traditional courts in the bill may not necessarily be the courts, may not necessarily be already also recognized under the Chapter 12 recognition. And then he points out that there is a possibility then, in light of the interpretation that may be given to these two provisions, Chapter 12 and Schedule 6, Item 16, there is already a legal quagmire or legal difficulty that has been created in light of the continued existence of the traditional courts. Now, the question that generally he poses and answers in all of the conceptualization and the ideas that he has spoken to is whether in the bill as it stands in the D version, is it the rationalization that is required in terms of Item 16, the realization that Parliament is pleased with and it wants to be producing? As per Schedule 16, Item 16, I have already indicated in sub 6A, the crucial question for this committee, which also the advocate asked, is to answer whether the bill as currently stand, does it rationalize traditional courts aligned with the judicial system suited to the requirement of the new constitution or not? Hence, everything that the advocate has raised in his opinion sought to alert and ask the committee whether or not this rationalization as it stands in the deep bill version, which both houses have passed, and it's now coming back in terms of Joint Rule 185 of Parliament and the National Assembly rules processing this matter. Is it meeting all the requirements in the Constitution. And his opinion basically deals with issues that have been addressed and issues that are not addressed to raise the question of constitutionality. He starts with Section 34. And as we all know, Section 34 is a right because it falls under Chapter 2 of the Bill of Rights. And it says everyone has the right to have any dispute capable of being of resolve or capable of being resolved by the application of law to be decided. And where must it be decided? It must be decided in a fair public hearing before, number one, either a court, and a court that will be forming part of the judicial system in Chapter 8 of the Constitution, or where it may be appropriate. And perhaps the question is to ask who decides what is appropriate and which forum. So it can be B, another independent and impartial tribunal. And lastly, it can be another independent or impartial tribunal or forum. And so the question that runs through the opinion, what does the bill choose or determine traditional courts to be? Is it a court under Chapter 8, or is it a tribunal or a forum that falls within the rights expressed in Section 34 of the Constitution? The advocate has broken down conceptual issues, and he starts with Section 34, pointing out, as I've said, it is a right. And these structures as independent and impartial tribunal or forums are allowed and enabled to exist. And he has made examples using the CCMA and using the small claims court. But the question for purposes of the traditional court, if they fall under either an impartial and independent tribunal or an impartial and independent forum, how such independence or impartiality of a tribunal is going to be established? And his argument is that if it is to be a court and must either be one of these two, the issue of independence and impartiality is an issue that creates challenges, because then if that were to be the case, they must be appointed in light of Chapter 8, specifically Section 174. And I will get to the specific provisions, how he suggests that be done. He points out furthermore that traditional leadership as such is a role, and its status is constitutionally declared as one found at local level, affecting local communities in order to accommodate the non-homogeneous and evolving cultures or traditions of all societies, so as to ensure that customary law lives on, and those that choose to follow the system or the lifestyle of customary law and customary traditions, they are enabled and able to do so. Now, the varied nature of our cultures is exactly what is catered for in terms of Chapter 12, and relevant and necessary applicable legislation must, in light of Section 7, assist customary law to reform. Furthermore, Chairperson, he speaks to the nature and character of traditional courts. If we look at paragraph 10 to 13 of Advocate Masugu's opinion, he speaks that, he indicates that traditional customary law or traditional courts may appear as an informal legal system as opposed to the formal legal system that was brought in by the Western colonization into the country. And so the concepts as understood and spoken may make it appear as an informal legal system as opposed to the known general Western formal legal system. And the way it's been argued, he further says, they may seem to lack the attribute of independence and impartiality. And why is that? Because he feels that they are being appendaged because of the way the customary system is. They are appendaged not as a court system, not as a judicial system, but as part of the traditional authority, which is the authority recognized under Chapter 12. He says that the traditional justice systems have been evolving as people following the culture is also evolving, as well as because of the advent of the constitution, which requires that things be done in a democratic as well as in a system that enables equality and promotes the rights in the Bill of Rights. He then points out that the traditional justice systems, as evolving as they have been, is the legislation that's in place ensuring certain features of their independence and impartiality, is the formation, the purpose and composition in line with the injunction in section 39(2) of the Constitution. And briefly, what section 39(2) of the Constitution is setting out is the following, Chairperson, so that members walk through with me in this. I'll quickly read it. When interpreting any legislation and when developing the common law or customary law, every court, tribunal, or forum must promote the spirit, purport, and object of the Bill of Rights. So the question he's posing there is the manner the bill, because it speaks to the formation, purpose, continuity, and composition of the traditional courts, does it comply with Section 39(2) of the Constitution and ensures that the Bill of Rights and its object is actually promoted as the Constitution purports? He further brings in the issue of legal representation, which the members also spoke about, and previous opinions have been presented to the committees, both the Select and the Portfolio Committee, whether legal representation being restricted as the bill does when conducting the system of traditional courts. Is that a constitutional issue? Is that a ground likely to make the bill unconstitutional or susceptible to constitutional invalidity? And then he speaks about issues whether abuse of judicial discretion in that the way the traditional courts are appendaged to the traditional authority will create problems thereof. He does raise concerns on whether the rule of law can be maintained and promoted in all the proceedings of the traditional courts without legal representation. He further contrasts, having questioned that generally speaking, and knowing customary law and the research he has done, legal representation was not necessarily part of traditional systems, because they were inbuilt systems that were promoting the protection of the parties and the open use of the system being communal, that it involves everybody as its own inbuilt system to promote and protect the integrity of the traditional court system. And then he speaks to generally fundamental differences between traditional or what is known or termed as informal justice system against the formal legal system, as I pointed out, which comes from the Western way of doing justice. However, having pointed out those distinctions, he does not say that the argument that there is a distinction in the preferred and the lack of legal representation in the traditional courts justify that and promotes the argument that the bill may be unconstitutional, because he takes it under Section 35, I think it's 3F of the Constitution, which enables and gives a right that every accused must be given legal representation in criminal matters. And then Chairperson, he then asked if traditional courts are rationalized in line with Section 166E and 171 of the Constitution. Many of the issues which arise and are related to the issues of legal representation, to the issues of independence, many of those concerns can be kept, as he argues under paragraph 17 and 19. And he argues that both systems, whether you look at a traditional system or a Western system, both systems are seeking to ensure the interest and promotion of a fair trial. And this is at the heart of both systems. And the traditional system then, in his argument, is the one that provides more substantial justice as opposed to the technical justice, because it's inclusive and it looks into ensuring that the offender still maintains his existence or her existence within the community, and ensures, as opposed to the retaliated system, it ensures a harmonious unity and keeping together the community. Hence, he says it's a substantial justice as opposed to a technical kind of justice that the Western system sort of brings. Making his summary on the legal representation issue, he cautions the committee that it must be mindful of the preoccupation with the Western jurisprudence and procedural mode, where they are saying legal representation is the norm and must always be there. Because, as I already pointed out, in the history of the traditional South African courts, such was not necessarily a question that ends up making a conclusion that without legal representation, then the system is unfair, unconstitutional, and cannot bring about justice. He argues that exclusion of legal representation can be maintained and it can be lawfully permitted in certain settings. And as already our own legislation in the statute as we speak of now, the legislation that establishes and sets procedure for small claims courts and CCMA, it does not include the right directly of legal representation. But the rules board and the rules that are related there and the jurisprudence that has been done by those courts or independent tribunals or forum as the CCMA is, they do look into the issues when it's necessary and valid that legal representation should be there. So his conclusion is that the lack of legal representation does not necessarily render the bill to be suspect to unconstitutionality in light of Section 35 of the Constitution. He has then further defined and made an expression on what does access to justice in light of Section of Clause 32E of the bill, and wants to ask the question related to the voluntariness or the opting out issues, which he believes that 32E seeks to promote Section 31 of the Constitution in voluntary association and in providing for voluntary association and adherence to customary law or cultural life, and as well as that provision, because it also precludes intimidation in any of its forms. So in that regard, that provision, he's arguing that it does speak expressly to access to justice and enables still the voluntary association for those who choose to follow the customary or cultural lifestyle. He further argues that the safeguards that are inbuilt in various provisions of the bill, for an example, the types of sanctions under Clause 8 and the orders, there is a sanction that provides, that prohibits deprivation of one's belonging into that area and detention. So these are some of the provisions he speaks to say the way they've been captured, they do look into the issues of ensuring constitutionality and compliance with the Bill of Rights. He says the bill conforms with the fundamental principles of natural justice, gender equality as required by Section 9, and it does addresses and is clear on procedural fairness, impartiality, and also speaks furthermore to the disclosure of interest and leaders to recuse themselves when there is a conflict of interest, which are the issues that fall under natural justice and these he finds them to be central to customary law or traditional law as practiced. Further concept he speaks of is the concept of fairness under natural justice. He urges that the members should avoid the lens or the perspective that is generally used to consider a traditional system in comparison and also undermining that it can stand on its own and as a plural legal system that's enabled by the constitution at the expense that the Western formal system is provided is promoted more and the traditional legal system is unfairly preconceived from the colonial founded thinking that it is not a system that can function and can survive. He mentioned the judgments of the Constitutional Court, which has given credence to the plural system of enabling both the Western justice system and the traditional justice system. And he says that the arguments do not on the issue of separation of powers, as I indicated, that he spoke a lot about the way they seem to be appendaged to the traditional authority. He says that such arguments as ill-conceived should not be used and considered from that lens, but give the traditional system, the traditional court system, a fair standing, which must align with what is required under Schedule 6 of Item 16 in the Constitution. He has made these arguments under paragraph 36 to 38 of his opinion. He further adds that from the way he studied the bill, there is a built-in remedy that the community holds and may use to hold the leadership of traditional authorities accountable, and that protection is available and protected by the bill in order to ensure accountability at all levels. And he also noted that in light of the Traditional and Khoisan Leadership Act, which is the act that has repealed the previous Traditional Leadership Framework Act, it still speaks to the different levels and structures of traditional leaders. And that is the same that has been used in order to ensure the court systems and the court structures within the traditional courts. And then coming to clause by clause, a point that he made out, Chairperson, and the difficulties in relation to the concept, Advocate Masuhu mentioned matters that may make the bill suspect to constitutional attacks. The main one, as I've indicated, is the issue that traditional courts seems to be appendaged and fused with the traditional leader, as the recognition under Section 12, 211 and 212 of the Constitution. And therefore, most may argue that because of that, there is a lack of separation of powers principle, which is required in any court system by the current final Constitution as the supreme law of the country. And therefore, he says a traditional court having its space linked with the governance and the political structure as understood within the traditional communities, there might be a problem with that and make it suspect to constitutional attacks. Therefore, maybe in his suggestion, the clarity that it is a court under Chapter 8, separating the issue of separation of powers principle and bringing the recognition of traditional courts under Chapter 8 that might assist, and as well as the certification judgment, which did make a view that if traditional courts are placed under Section 166E of the Constitution and read with Schedule 6, Items 2 and 16, that might correct that issue. But that will require that the appointment and the formulation be based under Section 174 and 171 of the Constitution, which the bill does not do currently. And he is clear in his assertion that for him, traditional courts should be placed as courts under the judicial system and not possibly going around Section 34 or using Section 34. So because traditional courts will be performing and are performing a judicial function, that is why he says they are solely to be placed under the judicial system and follow at least the Section 166E that establishes them through a legislation enacted by Parliament. He then makes an assertion whether the bill meets constitutional objective in its formation, establishment, and appointment. He finds that that is not the case because the bill does not recognize and form traditional courts within the constitutional contours of Section 166, Section 171, Section 174, and 211(3) of the Constitution. And in his argument is that this national legislation should have set out the details in light of those provisions, and unfortunately the bill does not do so. Traditional courts, in his argument, can pass constitutional muster if their design is in conformity with sections 8 and section 9 of the Constitution to ensure that the Bill of Rights in its entirety is not undermined, and also conform with section 165 and 166 of the Constitution. He has outlined and made the details of this under paragraph 54 and 55 of his opinion. He is making a caution there that we must avoid the committee or the processing of the bill in Parliament must ensure that the inflation and the putting together of traditional courts and traditional leadership is not done as one, because there is clearly a distinction and an inherent requirement that that separation be maintained. If it must be maintained through legislation, then it has to be so. He further points out that no one is mandated to interfere with courts as enjoined by Section 165(3) of the Constitution. But how can we argue that the same can be achieved in light of traditional courts, especially in following the arguments that were raised by some of the submissions where they were saying traditional courts must be within a judicial system? He further argues that the independence of this structure, traditional courts, is crucial. And if it's a court, it will be properly established. And then even under Section 34, because Section 34 also enables the right to approach a court. So there is really no argument that one can say if traditional courts are a court, they then fall outside of Section 34, because it can either be a court, it can either be an impartial and independent tribunal or forum. And therefore, he's urging, in his opinion, or perhaps the arguments are making a view that there has to be a distinction of the independence of traditional courts, which stands outside and away from the traditional leadership as recognized under Section 211 of the Constitution. He concludes that it is possible to establish a traditional court that conforms fully with the Constitution if they will be placed under Chapter 8 and their formation and appointment of the presiding officers there will not necessarily follow the inheritance succession as customary does, but if it will be done through legislation and the rules board, which is already in existence in respect of the other courts. He further points out that the apex court, the constitutional court, has accepted the legal and cultural pluralism that needs to subsist within the South African democratic state and ensure people's choice which legal system they follow. He cautions that the continued existence of traditional courts must not continue the unconstitutional extension of political power of traditional leaders, which is fused with the traditional court's powers as appendaged currently, and therefore the bill must make sure, in order to avoid unconstitutionality in this regard, that that principle is clearly separated and expressed in the bill. In the establishing of the norms and standards for traditional courts, Advocate Masugu argues that what appears is that the bill has taken what the Constitution was granting to the structures as set out for courts' purposes and courts' establishment, where another public officer or functionary is conferred with the power to make prescripts that regulate traditional courts. That will create an issue because it usurps the powers of the Chief Justice as conferred in Section 165(6) of the Constitution. And giving those powers elsewhere, as the bill does, may also render the bill unconstitutional if taken for the court's attack and review in courts. He points out that the concern of usurping the powers of the Chief Justice may come clear when one reads clauses 5, 7 on sub 11, and clauses 10 sub 2, and clauses 16 and 17. The powers and the way those provisions are giving out what needs to be done there, especially if Parliament agrees that traditional courts are to be courts under Section 166E and not merely independent tribunals or forums that are found, as pointed out and envisaged in Section 34 of the Constitution. He says the solution lies in perhaps, if it's not done in the bill itself, the power to be delegated to the rules board by the bill instead of giving it to the executive, the minister or the MEC or the House of Traditional Leaders, where there's an indication that they can determine the scope of how these authorities conduct themselves when running a traditional court in terms of a code of conduct. He further points out that according to Section 176(2) of the Constitution, Parliament is obliged to legislate on the security and tenor and removal and guidelines for judicial officers, but that is not the case in respect of the traditional courts, and that again on its own may render the bill suspect to constitutional attack. So there needs to be compliance with Section 176(2), with Section 174(7) and Section 165(3) of the Constitution. These are all related provisions for the protection and ensured formation of an independent judicial system. And he argues the bill lacks some of it thereof. In terms of the definitions and the preamble, as I said, he also does speak per clause. And these are the first clauses within the bill. The preamble, he says, has lots of problems. And he suggests some of the provisions within the preamble to be removed, because if we maintain them, the preamble will create interpretive chaos. The obligation to rationalize traditional courts does not arise from the Black Administration Act. So he says what appears in paragraph 1 and 2 will create chaos that we really do not need, and therefore perhaps the paragraphs 1 and 2 of the preamble should come out. He also points out that in respect of paragraph 3 of the preamble, which is supposed to be an interpretative tool assisting the content and the context and the reason why the bill had to be enacted, he says regarding the various facets of traditional authority, he does not agree that Chapter 12 recognizes traditional leadership as a dispute-resolving mechanism. as a dispute resolving mechanism or function, though traditional framework act did exactly that. So he says the sole domain of courts must be separated from the domain of traditional leadership as a recognized traditional authority. He further points out, I think when I checked the act, it was me who went straight. For an example, if one looks at section 15 of the Traditional and Khoisan Leadership Act, he points out that the old framework act did confer the dispute resolution power of or such a function to traditional leadership. But section 15 and section 19 or 20 and 25 of the current Traditional and Khoisan Leadership Act, which has repealed the old framework act, that does not speak to those issues or enabling and granting such a power. So furthermore, on the preamble, he then suggests that we either remove paragraph 4 and revise paragraph 5 of the preamble so as to avoid the interpretation chaos that might arise with how the preamble is set out right now. He's further worried with some definitions under clause 1, including the definition of the traditional court, which he says is generally vague and just does not bring so much clarity because it relates to what the levels in the traditional leadership framework, in the traditional and Khoisan Act currently is also understanding and promoting the way the structural levels of traditional authorities are. So he suggests that maybe we need to refine the definition of traditional courts. Clause 2 as well, he says we may need to look at revising it in order to ensure that the issues that he has raised are clarified. So there are various provisions that he feels do require revision in order to ensure that they meet constitutional muster. Clause 3 and clause 4 are some of those, especially on the issue of the manner that traditional leaders take up position. He says the inheritance story should really be taken away and that appendage issue be clarified, because traditional leaders should be then, even if as leaders, they should be appointed as judicial officers, which will run the traditional court, and that will accord and align with the constitution, as well as promote judicial independence. Therefore, we need to make sure that the bill aligns itself, if it is a court under Section 166, enacted through legislation by Parliament, we must ensure compliance with Section 165 and 174 of the Constitution. He makes those arguments under paragraph 83 to 84. And clause 5 as well would require that it be relooked at. And he points out that a clear decision needs to be made on the nature of these courts, because the bill currently is really not clear whether they are Chapter 8 or they are Section 34. The committee may recall that previously the legal opinions were arguing that if it's a Section 34 tribunal, and that's why it's located within the manner that it's been determined and the bill was presented before and right through the committee. So he says failing a clear expression that it's a Chapter 8 court or it falls within the judicial system, and insisting that they be kept as a Section 34 impartial tribunal, and but the independence issue stands out, then without that, an argument that can stand also is that the appendage will continuously violate the separation of powers constitutional principle and not suffice as envisaged a proper rationalization that Schedule 6 of the Constitution requires. He suggested that the legitimacy of this institutional role can be protected if a representative body as opposed to a cabinet member alone does what is set out in clause 5.3 of the bill. He challenges clause 6 and 7 and points that there are inconsistencies in the manner that they are drafted. It is inconsistent with the promotion and the need for judicial independence and the separation of powers. He has issues with 7.3b, subsection 2. He says the bill is not clear whether it's saying it's a procedure or a decision that needs to be fair, because in light of procedural fairness and natural justice, the process needs to be impartial as conducted by the presiding traditional leader and not necessarily the decision. But the bill speaks of this in a convoluted or other confused way that that does not align with this. So he points out that the issue of legal representation being restricted under 7.4a of the bill, he makes his full argument under paragraph 19.4. He points out that this is meant and restricted to criminal matters. But if the bill does extend to criminal matters, such a right cannot then be deprived and taken away from those that will require it where there are complex and problematic issues. He says 7.8 is also challengeable because it's vague. And then clause 7 and 8 further, he says on the doctrine of vagueness and lacking legal certainty on customary procedure and methods of evidence, clause 7.8 then may make the bill suspect to constitutional challenges. In summary, to give the nature and impact of the way the bill is currently structured, he says clause 9 can be cured if all adjudicative roles, once the nature of these courts is confirmed and placed under chapter 8, section 166E, these courts can then be given back to presiding officers and taken away from the clerks. The functions that are given under clause 9 should remain as functions of the judicial officers and not the functions of the clerks, but that the bill did under the understanding that it puts it under section 34 of the Constitution. So a nature of this bill still required to be clarified, and the bill needs to be clear as well in respect of the transfer provisions under clause 14, whether the traditional courts are made to be lower than the magistrate courts, and what then is the purpose of the transfer if they are at an equal level. It must be clear whether that transfer or the referral is a review or appeal process or what it is. He says there is vagueness in respect of that, and the bill must verify, even though it was a noble idea to have such a provision. So the bill must clarify what the referral or the transfer of this matter is exactly, and whether the traditional courts are lower than the magistrate courts. In conclusion then, Chairperson, he makes distinction of these two matters. Judicial power given to traditional leaders, as the bill does not in its current form is displaced and constitutionally invalid in consideration of, or if we placed it under the recognition of section 211, because as I said, he says that recognition is recognition for the traditional leadership outside of the traditional courts, because the traditional courts are recognized under Schedule 12, under Schedule 6, existing as they are as courts within this part of the judicial system. So traditional authority as currently recognized by the Constitution in Chapter 12 does not extend to grant judicial authority as protected and enabled to continue to exist under Schedule 6, Item 16 of the Constitution. Then he says there has to be a correct conferral of judicial power. And if that is done in the bill, then the constitutional issues that are raised may just be solved. He also points out that in respect of the opt-out principle, on its own, it may promote disregard for the equality before the law principle, because it seems to be indicating that there is a choice, and that choice is not necessarily given when one considers the Western legal system type. So he indirectly does point out that the opt-out principle has its own challenges as well, which may might as well leave when argued before the courts of law. That said, Chairperson, he is giving us a very balanced opinion, which says there may be work necessary to be done on the traditional courts bill, but a concept that is not in its general form to be made as if it's entirely unconstitutional. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ngema, for the presentation. And thank you very much. I think you have really studied the legal opinion. You've internalized it. Members, that is the presentation from Ms. Ngema of the legal opinion drafted by Advocate Masuku SC, which we asked him to do. Remember the last meeting we had, we asked for an external legal opinion, and that is the legal opinion. Are there any views? Honorable Horn?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And also thank you to the presenter. Chair, I want to say in respect of the very last comments that I don't think the opinion as it stands can lead to any other conclusion if we accept the opinion than that on the basis of the probable failure to pass constitutional muster, this committee is now confronted with very serious issues. I mean, I think I will park any comments on the way forward. I would assume we firstly want to discuss the content. I think the opinion in itself, even though it is phrased very carefully, points out very clearly the themes within the bill that is problematic from a constitutional point of view, but also in terms of the specific sections. And on the two scores, the one being the separation of powers principle and everything related to that, as well as ultimately the equality before the law principle and the opt-out provision that is not there, I would think that a careful reading of the opinion must lead to a conclusion on our part that these matters are fatal to the constitutional validity of this bill, and that realization must inform our discussions on the way forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. Honorable Masuku Chele.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And also let me just thank our presenter
for indeed such a good analysis of the opinion in front of us, Chair, today. There are a lot of things that have been raised by this opinion that, Chair, really have to be considered. And also, Chair, are of a concern to some of us who are not expert on this field, but also, you know, coming from this tradition, the traditional African traditions. There are a lot of them. And Chair, I'm not sure if maybe, like Honorable Horn says, we're still going to have an opportunity to deal with the content in details, but there are issues that are of a concern here that our advocate has alluded to, particularly that issue of separation of powers and the legal representation. Chair, I think as we are going to discuss this one, we need to make sure that, Chair, some of the things that are proposed on this opinion are not I don't want to be seen like I'm criticizing maybe now at this moment where I am, but I would feel like we must not compare the two formal legal system and this one of the traditional the system from the traditional background, because those two are different. And how we are going to handle them, they should reflect that indeed they are different. Because if we are going to allow some elements from the formal legal system to penetrate into this one, into our tradition, in a manner, I know, Chair, I'm cautious of what the clause in our constitution in relation to this, but we must also, because all these issues they take interpretation into consideration. But Chair, without going further, I think there are so many points where the opinion also says this might cause, you know, some problems if they are challenged in our courts, the present courts that we have. But I don't think that, Chair, we are, or let me say, I agree with some of the points that the opinion is talking into, but I'm not sure if maybe, Chair, you are going to give us a lot of time, maybe tomorrow, to go into details in making sure that we support what we are feeling, that the opinion is really not making one to be comfortable when it comes to our African tradition. Chairperson, I don't want to get into details, because when it comes also to the issue of comparing this traditional courts with the issues of the small claim courts and all that, I still have a different view when it comes to that one, Chair. And also the issue of the legal representation, I have a different view, because when you're talking legal representation, you are also, we are now bringing that element into the tradition, which originally it was not supposed to be like that. I agree with the opinion where it says we have to apply our mind carefully when we do these things. But Chair, I think I will, where I am now, I will pause and wait for that opportunity when we get into details with this issue so that we can support also some of our points raised on this legal opinion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Jale, Honorable Deputy Minister.
Thanks, Chair. Look, just a few comments. And firstly, I'm glad to see that Mr. Horn is so much in support of Mr. Zuma's advocate. I hope it will extend, or I wonder if it will extend to other issues that he argues. But look, my overall problem with the opinion is Advocate Masuku, traditional courts are traditional courts. They're created by tradition in terms of African customary law. Advocate Masuku seems to want, and in terms of that tradition, they are led by traditional leaders. It differs according to different parts of the country, but it basically depends on it's usually chaired by a traditional leader, or a traditional leader appoints a panel, as I think is happening in the Northwest. Advocate Masuku wants us to have traditional courts without traditional leaders. So that's my fundamental problem. How is that possible? The other issue I just want to raise is that this bill was passed by both houses. The issue before this committee is accepting or rejecting the NCOP amendments. And this is going a lot further than that. The issue, the main issues that the committee at the time had problems with was the issue of legal representation and the issues of the absence of an express opt-out clause. On both of those issues, Advocate Masuku has not found any problem with the wording relating to those. And in fact, on the opt-out clause, he feels he goes even further to say it would be unconstitutional to have an opt-out, an express opt-out clause. I don't even know if I agree with that aspect. But what is the committee meant to do? The other thing to point out is that the power to, or the president has the power, if he believes a bill may be unconstitutional, to refer it back to parliament. So basically, procedurally, I'm not sure if the committee does want to follow Advocate Masuku's proposals. Is it empowered to in terms of both the constitution and the rules of parliament? Whereas one other remedy would be to get the president to refer the bill back if he feels it's unconstitutional, and then there's greater scope for parliament. But the main problem I've got with the opinion is I don't see how you can have traditional courts without traditional leaders. And also just to say that we passed the South African Judicial Education Act, which sets up a council for judicial education to make it independent. On that council sits a representative of traditional leaders, because the idea was that, and that person sits on the council with the Chief Justice, because the issue was that traditional leaders need training in running traditional courts. So that issue that Advocate Masuku raises has not been raised before. In fact, most of these issues, I mean, this bill has been subject to extensive public comment, and the previous versions also, these points that Advocate Masuku is raising, I don't recall them being raised before. So it's I would say, his view, which obviously everybody can have a view in terms of the constitution, and issues can get argued in the constitutional court, but it doesn't mean that somebody, one person's view is the correct view. But Chair, my main problem is this issue of He's wanting traditional courts without traditional leaders. Are they then traditional courts? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister John Jeffrey. Honorable Janke.
Thank you very much. Let me greet colleagues and everybody in the meeting. Let me follow you, Chair, with the appreciation of the quality of the presentation, well prepared, well understood, and the eloquence of it by the legal advisor. I want to add my voice to what you said, but I immediately want to say this as I appreciate this well thought of and beautiful presentation, that it's one thing to have a well articulated presentation, but that well articulated presentation doesn't automatically take you in that because it's so well articulated that it passes the constitutional muster. Because there's an ability to take us through this so that we understand, so that when we have to criticize, you're well informed why you have got to criticize this point. So I'm appreciating that, Ms. Ngema, but I think I would want to invite you that perhaps if I make comments that do not necessarily go with you in the corners that you went to, it must be understood in the sense that this is a diversity of views and discussions. Because the starting point is that what we have here is a legal view, it's an opinion, and it is that. It must be our starting point. The second point I want to make, I think it's in reference to my colleague, the Honorable Horn, before I raise my own issues. He is very uncharacteristic today. I know him as somebody who gets into the issues. But I think the way he started today surprised me because he's raised a flag. Basically, that says, don't open that door. Don't go this way. There's one way to go to. And I'm not sure if it was a smart way of influencing debate in that way. It's somehow a flag, a lift. And that flag that you're carrying says, there's one dimensional decision we must take here. I don't know if I agree. With that approach. Without you getting to the issues, you have just made the point that it seems that the presentation takes us to one conclusion. I might have a different view in relation to that. The first point, Chair, I want to make in contribution to this, having listened to the presentation, but also having gone through both the bill and the drop on a number of occasions, is the fact that, colleagues, that traditional courts, as we know them, have been in existence, will continue to exist with or without this bill. And I want to emphasize that point, that traditional courts have been in existence, they will continue to exist with or without this bill. And that should say something about the issues that are being raised in this legal opinion by Senior Counsel Masuku. I would have wanted him to have gone further and assisted in making the views he's making, whether we would need a frame that would ensure consistency with the Republic, the Constitution of the Republic. Because I think that there's a remedy there that would assist us in this. But certainly I don't think he would have gone that far. And so in my first point, I really want to say this, because I think this will tie in with what the deputy minister was raising of wanting a chicken but without its eggs, or wanting the eggs without these eggs bearing a chicken. It's such a contradiction that I think you have pointed out in the legal opinion of you in front of us. But also secondly, to carry the view also that says that traditional justice does affirm the values of restorative justice, because with it, as we have always known, as it is currently in place and it's likely to be the issue going forward, that you have this ownership by the people who are experiencing, who are interacting with this form of restorative justice. It is happening as we speak. So you've got a big ownership, people believe in it, people practice it, people are directed by it. You can go to a number of provinces, that's what you have. And so it is important that therefore the traditional justice system gets to be understood within the customary law paradigm in which it operates, especially in our country, given the fact that traditional courts themselves are a unique feature that you are unlikely to just do away with or deform it or part of it, do away with it because the legal opinion suggests that. I think Honorable the Deputy Minister would have spoken and Honorable Maseko Jele very briefly that on the issues of the separation of powers, again, one is not convinced by what is being raised in the legal opinion. I don't think that it is the legal opinion was able to give us enough and proper context on this issue of the separation of powers. You could even go to even the issues around your legal representation. We have examples that exist that we can point to, whether you speak about the Small Claims Court, the CCMA, and so on, without me getting into the details about that. But I think the contribution as a first take chair that I want to make for this discussion is that this being in front of us, coming from the NCOP, I have no reason, I find nothing not to support what the NCOP has and its reasoning of supporting the bill, and I would want to urge and persuade that we go along that. Honorable Hans said when it comes to way forward, we'll have to speak about that. I'm therefore depositing a few points around that way forward as to where it should be going. And the main part of it is that I am in support of the NCOP endorsement of this. I pause there for now, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janji, Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. and thank you for allowing me again. I did not necessarily understand your initial request to invite a full and complete submission on the presentation. But nonetheless, the Honorable Janki obviously disagreed and gave us his full spiel, which I must at the outset say, Honorable Janki, I think finally indicates that the ANC of pre-2019 in this committee seems to be back. The commitment to constitutionalism and the rule of law today was put on the back burner by specifically your presentation. And I'll point out why, Chair, given the fact that the Honourable Jayanti invited me to substantiate my argument a bit further. At the outset, also allow me to say to the Deputy Minister, I don't know whether in his world it operates, he operates on a basis that the law is really a clear science. I would think that one must always look at arguments rather than personalities. But if he wants to, we can take our cue from his submission and agree that we will, as a matter of course, want to disagree with him always. I don't know whether he would want that. Chair, that brings me to the merits and the demerits of this whole saga. Firstly, in respect of the argument of the Deputy Minister that the portion of the legal opinion around separation of powers and specifically positioning the traditional courts as either courts or tribunals, that we must ignore that part because that has never been part of the deliberations and arguments around this, I want to respectfully say that the Deputy Minister is of course wrong. When this bill was deliberated during the previous parliament, there was spent a significant amount of time and argument on specifically this issue. And it was the narrow-minded obsession of the majority of the committee during that period, which insisted that in order for traditional courts to be afforded the same level as courts in terms of our common and statutory law, that in no way can these courts be deemed to be tribunals and they must be courts. So it is absolutely not true that this specific issue was not at the center of discussions and specifically oppositional views. And the consequences today that we sit with this provision, which has been pointed out by the advocate as very problematic. So in that brings me, Chair, to the other problematic aspect, which I think is hampering the way forward in respect of regulation of the traditional courts. It cannot be that we turn a blind eye to the constitutional provision to the effect that customary law is incorporated into our body of law in as far as it is consistent with the Constitution, constitutional values and principles. It is somewhat intriguing, but also very problematic, that some colleagues tend to hold the view that whilst the rest of our body of law, and rightfully so, is subject to a constant process of transformation in order to enrich it with constitutional values and principles, that in respect of this specific matter, the problematic aspects around customary law and the institutions of customary law must be left untouched and not be transformed in order to ensure that constitutional muster is met. So with a very simple, I'm not agreeing with this legal opinion. The Honourable Jayanti then says, I'm very comfortable with what the NCOP has proposed. That might be his choice and it might be the advice, if not instruction, the ANC study committee received. But let me make it very clear. That does not take away from the problematic aspects that has been part of this bill right from the start. And for us to consider even turning a blind eye to the issues pointed out by the legal opinion which we asked for, because at that stage everybody in the committee shared the sentiment that there's issues around this bill and possibly the constitutionality of the bill. If the majority ultimately going forward wants to then turn a blind eye to it, let me make it very clear, we will not be part of it. The issues remain, and ultimately, when this bill, if it is now passed on the insistence of the majority, will be struck down or be returned back on the basis of constitutionality, then the majority today will have to take ownership of it. Lastly, Chair, I want to say, and maybe that's also why the law is so interesting, my reading of the comments of the advocate around the opt-out clause is not the same as that of the Deputy Minister. While the advocate do not go into great detail on the issue, and whilst he definitely argues that an opt-out clause in principle would be not be constitutional, unconstitutional, he also makes it very clear that ultimately the failure to deal with disputes around the applicability of the customary law in a specific circumstances and a dispute as to whether the traditional courts are to be used, the failure by this bill to address this in any way or form also leads to a problem that may lead to a successful legal attack. And in that sense, Chair, I also want to say this is also the product of the narrow-minded obsession of the majority component of this portfolio committee in the previous parliament, when the arguments went something to the effect of irrespective of whether you're just traveling through a geographical area where a traditional court might have authority, you must be subject to this without any recourse, alternative appeal, etc., etc. And what I take from the opinion in this regard is that whilst our opinion around the opt-out clause is not necessarily shared, what is pointed out is that the failure to deal with this and to treat this like a blunt, and the way this bill treats this issue like a blunt instrument, must ultimately also lead to very specific issues that can work into the validity of this bill. So yes, Chair, then maybe in conclusion, it is so. We now faced with actually the very simple choice, whether we accept the amendments made by the NCOP to this bill or not. And then, of course, if we do not accept it, there is a procedural process or a procedural requirement for a dispute committee to be set up, etc., etc. I want to say that we all know, irrespective of whether we're going to try through verbal gymnastics to now varnish over the serious and the fatal deficiencies in this bill or not, we all know they're there. The responsible way forward for legislators who swore an oath of allegiance to our constitution in the current circumstances will be to say we cannot give our concurrence to the bill in its current format, and then let the dispute committee process kick in, and let us then give effect to the fact that this bill is constitutionally fatally flawed. If the majority decides to go another route, let we make it very clear. It will not be without our blessing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn, Honorable Maseko Jele.
Thank you very much, Chair. After the deliberation of the views. In fact, let me start where at the point where agreeing with the DM that Chair, what is traditional courts without traditional leaders? Because the traditional leaders, we are talking about the functionality of these courts. How come now we want to leave the people who came with the idea originally, the leaders who came with the idea when it comes to this? We understand, yes, we must be guided by the Constitution, but we still feel that the Constitution covers these leaders, Chairperson, when it comes to the recognition. But I also wanted, Chair, to say I also agree that we need to accept what is coming from the NCOP. I agree with Honorable Janji on that issue. But I also want to go back to the issue of the literature that is outside, Chair, when it comes to what is happening around Africa in terms of these issues or the matter that we are about to hear today. When we look at the literature, Chair, the literature shows that in Botswana, for example, I want to make an example with that one, that the rule is explicit, Chair, that no legal representation is allowed in traditional courts, inclusive of cases where the matter goes on appeal to the magistrate court, Chair. And also when we look at Zimbabwe, next door, there's a country next to us here also. In Zimbabwe, legal representation is not allowed at all. And the presiding officer is supposed to conduct the proceedings in a loose and simple fashion. If this is one of the examples of saying, Chair, I want to come to the point of saying, this bill today is not the end of it. We will still continue, allowed by our democracy, our maturing of democracy, and also transformation that is taking place in our country, to work on these issues, those that some we feel that, Chairperson, they are not, people feel that they are not satisfied with. I want to agree, I want to say, let's allow this bill to pass. And then whatever that will be coming, we're not saying we are doing it obligatory, Chair. We are saying we have looked into all those issues, and we appreciate the work that done by our advocate. And advocate, we understand that he has done very good in interpreting this, but we still have to also bring our own opinion on this. So in short, I'm trying to say, Chair, I just want to support Honorable Janji. Let's adopt, we agree with whatever that comes, I mean to say, what comes from the NCOP today. This is not the ANC of the past, as Honorable Horn indicated. This is the ANC of 6th term, Chair. We have analyzed all these issues, we looked into them, but we feel that indeed we are agreeing with the NCOP on this matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can I, before I go to Honorable Deputy Minister, can I go to Ms. Ngema, then the Deputy Minister, then Honorable Janji, and Honorable Glenda Spreitenbach in that order?
Thank you so much, Chairperson. I think I just wanted to come in to clarify perhaps the question or the understanding on the issue of not wanting the egg, of wanting the eggs but not the chicken, or of not wanting the traditional, of wanting traditional courts without the traditional leaders. Chairperson, it is not my interpretation or reading of the opinion that the advocate is stating that. All that I am understanding from the opinion of the advocate in respect of that point, Chairperson, is that he is saying, yes, traditional courts exist and traditional leadership also exists. However, as the Constitution currently stands, for a traditional court to align itself with the provisions of the Constitution, the legislation needs to be clear on the appointment, whether it's confirming how it's done currently or it's dictating another way that will ensure the appointment of the same traditional leadership into being the officers in the judicial system and in the judicial court. I am understanding him to be indicating that point, that the appointment processes must be either legislated clearly, because if we leave it as they are, then it may continue the uncertainty and the issue of disregarding the argument or promoting the argument of lack of judicial independence and the required independence. So it doesn't say that traditional leadership must not be the one that sits as the presiding officers in the courts as the system currently is. But he's saying there is a need to legislate and be clear on that part. That is point number one, Chairperson. On the second point again, in terms of how he has argued legal representation, he in fact make references of case law that confirms what other members have indicated, that there is no room for legal representation in customary traditional law. And he is saying, he's making clear arguments, as we also pointed out, that there may be, Section 35.5 is there in the Constitution, but in light of the manner and how the traditional courts are run, room for legal representation cannot be made an argument to say it makes the Constitution and the existence of traditional courts invalid. They may exist with the continued position that legal representation is not granted directly and is not in existence and required for purposes of the traditional courts. So for me, the two and the manner that the council has made his argument, he is not really saying what I seem to be understanding the members to be indicating that argument. The point that says he's saying there should be no traditional court without traditional leadership. He's saying the appointment thereof must be very clear and align itself with the with what the Constitution dictates. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, we must bear in mind that at 2, it's debate number 2, Parliament, and we are all required to be in the House at that time. And so we, as we debate, we must bear that in mind. Honorable Deputy Minister.
Chair, I'm just having to get in a car to travel. Can I come next after the next person, please?
Oh, okay. Honorable Janji.
Chair, before I raise the issues, just a brief issue, just following up on Ms. Pumelele, because we normally have an approach here, Chair, where a presenter is given a chance to respond at the end. Maybe there's something that was drastic that needed to be explained, because we would have listened to her for an hour as members of the committee. I accept the clarity that she's making, but I was expecting that you will still give her the chance to speak, but I didn't want to have an impression that she's very involved in the legal opinion in terms of not creating a distance about what she's presenting and what we need. Because here, we're raising our own views and discussions about the matter. I hear what she says in the clarity. I have no problem with that. But I think just in terms of our practice, because we must be allowed as members to get into our discussion and she was going to be given the space to make her comments. That's the first point. The second point I want to make before I go to what I'm suggesting again, I just listening to Honorable Horn, and again, I find this very uncharacteristic of him. There is going to be no amount, Honorable Horn, because the issue is here, we have different views on matters. There's going to be no amount of how somebody can attempt to gag us into a particular conclusion. There's no amount of blackmailing us back into 2019. Some of us were not there, and we don't know what happened, and there's no context brought into this, because the way you're going about it, we must feel so ashamed, because you're giving us an ANC that was thrashing the constitution, doing this in 2019. I'm not sure if that helps in terms of this debate. We all correctly were having concerns. We asked for a legal opinion, like any other legal opinion that we ask for. There is nothing that says because you have asked for this legal opinion that you must agree with it in total. There's nothing like that. We've done this before. This is our own legal opinion we ask for. We're sharing different opinions and views about what it is being presented to us. So we can't be put into a corner because you've asked for this kind of a legal opinion. And therefore, get our contributions even painted to those who are raising this point, who are not agreeing with you, and therefore we must be seen as all who are carrying is just an ANC caucus position. I don't think we should go into that space. That's not how we operate in this committee. This is a melting pot of vibrant ideas, always been like that. I mean, you're very harsh even saying there's this narrow-minded obsession. Because you don't like the views we're carrying, you've got to give us such kind of labels. I am asking Chair that we get into this robust discussion, but I don't think that the kind of labels, including that if you don't agree with this, it seems that our allegiance and the oath that we have taken must be under question. I want to end, Chair, again and saying we are here today to comment, to agree or not agree on the issues that on the amendments, technical and otherwise, that were done by the NCOP. And I want to repeat that we're in support of those amendments of the NCOP. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Tanji. Honorable Dennis Breckenbach.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and good afternoon, good morning, good morning to everybody. Chairperson, this bill, in our view, is unconstitutional. We are now, and we always have been, of the view that the absence of an opt-out clause in this piece of legislation renders it unconstitutional. Women in South Africa are seriously marginalized, always have been, and are still deeply marginalized in our deeply patriarchal society. This bill, instead of uplifting women, instead of increasing their options, instead of allowing them the opportunity to take control of their own destiny, entrenches this patriarchal and unfair approach. I wanted to be clear, Honourable Chairperson, that I have the highest regard for customary law as a legal system, and there must be an equal place for it in the South African legal framework. This is not an attack on customary law. But this bill wants to entrench deeply patriarchal, in my view, unfair positions of women that cannot be justified, and this bill will be passed at the expense of women and women's rights. I cannot agree to that on any level, Mr. Chairperson. Our interpretation of the application of an opt-out clause has always differed quite sharply from that of the Deputy Minister, and so there's no surprise that we don't agree. This bill in its current form is an affront to women. When the Honourable Msimang is quite done.
Honourable Msimang, can you mute yourself?
This bill will make women's access to real justice, practical, everyday, real justice, much more difficult than it is for them now, and already now, it's extremely difficult. We're not talking about women in business suits who drive fancy cars in the cities. We're talking about women in the rural areas who already have a struggle to access justice. This will make it harder. It's unconscionable. That's not the job of this committee. That's not the job of legislation in South Africa. Our job should be, our concentration should be centered on increasing the access of justice to people who currently don't have access. This bill will do nothing to achieve that. It will only entrench the difficulties. It will make it harder. It treats women like second-class citizens. It makes them out to be children. I cannot, I do not, I will never agree with it. If this committee rams this bill through the committee and then through Parliament, it will be delivering a severe injustice to all the women of South Africa. And Honourable Chair, I will come back and remind all of us that we said so. If this bill in its current iteration goes through Parliament, we will be delivering a severe injustice to women of South Africa. We're telling them again that they are less than equal. It cannot be right, Mr. Chair. It leaves me with a feeling of severe disquiet. Severe disquiet. The DA will not agree to this bill in its current iteration. And we completely distance ourselves from this approach. We do not support this bill. We hold the view that it will not pass constitutional muster. We want no part in passing unconstitutional legislation. This is a flawed piece of legislation, and we should not be inflicting it on the South African public. This bill should be withdrawn. We should continue working on it. We should find a way to make it acceptable to everybody. This process, this rush process of passing it, is not going to help. And when it comes back as unconstitutional, Mr. Chairperson, I will not be able to help myself but say I told you so. It leaves me feeling that we have failed the women of South Africa if this bill passes through Parliament. It does nothing to improve the position of women. It does nothing to increase the access of women to justice. And I'm not talking about women in the cities. I'm not talking about people like myself and people like the Honourable Maseko Jele and Honourable Niva Drachen, who can access justice at the drop of a hat. I'm talking about people who already have a daily struggle to access anything at all. And now we want to make it harder for them to access justice. Those women who need it most, we're going to let them down. We will have no part of it, and we do not support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Breitenbach. Honourable Deputy Minister, are you now in the position to speak?
Yeah, can you hear me, Chair?
Yes, we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Right, sure. No, I'm in the car, so I might cut. Let me just make some more general points to begin with. This bill is not creating traditional courts. Those traditional courts are there. They exist. They dispense justice on a regular basis. I was going to say every day, but probably they don't. Well, they might, yeah. This bill was not about there and bring it in line with the Constitution. There have been many attempts at the bill. This version came as the result of engagements with traditional leaders, the national houses, provincial houses, as well as the civil society. And the establishment of a reference group that actually drafted the bill. The bill that came to Parliament was the product of that reference group. That bill, just to remind the Honourable Breytenbach, because she seems to have forgotten, had an express opt-out clause, which the Portfolio Committee removed, but it made other changes as well. So previously in the bill that was introduced, there was no appeal to magistrates' courts, which there is now. There was just a review to the High Court, which is a little bit, I mean, unaffordable for most people. But just to point that out. The dispute, I mean, one thing where I agree with Honourable Horne is that constitutional law is not an exact science. You can have two constitutional lawyers and probably three constitutional opinions. It's ultimately the constitutional court sitting on bank altogether that will define what the Constitution, how the Constitution should be interpreted. And it may be at times they don't always get it right. But anyway, that's how our system works. You can have the High Court or the FCA saying something is unconstitutional, and the Constitutional Court will disagree with that. So let me just say that we have an opinion. We must consider that opinion. My concern with that opinion is that I disagree with the legal advisor. I mean, currently, traditional courts are established by or fall under traditional leaders, a traditional leader of a particular area, who are appointed because they are traditional leaders in terms of the Traditional Leaders and Khoisan Act. It used to be the Traditional Leaders Framework Act. Advocate Masuku seems to be wanting a different process to select people to preside over traditional courts. He also has a problem with traditional leaders presiding over courts because they're combining executive and judicial powers, which in terms of a reading of the Constitution, yes, it's not correct, but how can you have traditional courts without traditional leaders? They won't be traditional courts anymore. So anyway, that's just the background. The appeal to finalize the bill is that in spite, and I'll address what Honourable Breytenbach is saying, is that whilst until we have this bill, there's no real, or this bill becoming an act, there's no regulation of traditional courts. I think the fundamental issue, I actually think from a lot of people who oppose this bill, is they don't want traditional courts. Sometimes they are afraid to say so because it may not be politically correct, but that's ultimately what a number of people opposing traditional courts, I think their actual position is. But so basically, just in terms of responding to Honourable Horne, yes, I agree with you. It's not an exact science. This is one opinion. I disagree with that opinion. I also note that the issues being raised were not issues that were raised in any substantial way in the process of making the bill, and we also consulted traditional law academics. None of them raised the issue. These issues, as far as I'm concerned, were not raised in any substantial manner. The concern of the committee in terms of seeking the legal opinion was around particularly the constitutionality of not having an express opt-out clause. And when I say express, my argument would be actually there's nothing in the bill that forces people to participate in terms of there's a specific provision of if a matter, if the person doesn't pitch up, then it goes to the registrar or the whatever the equivalent is, and they can then decide to refer it to another court, which I understand is what happens in many areas where people don't want to be subject to a traditional court. But anyway, that was the one issue. The other issue was the issue of legal representation. Those were the issues that the DA was opposing before. Those issues, in fact, this opinion says that maybe Honourable Simang can switch his mic back off.
Honourable Simang is playing that card. Honourable Simang.
He's playing Maskandi.
Okay, can I continue? It seems he's
Okay.
So those were the issues, but the opinion actually doesn't support the DA. So they're also not in agreement with Advocate Masuku's opinion on those aspects, although they may then now claim opportunistically that they're in agreement on the other ones. Let's face it, the DA was never going to support this bill for whatever reason. On Honorable Breitenbach's thing on women, I must say that clause 5 of the bill, which deals with the issue of women, was not something that was something that was unanimously supported in the reference group. And that says a traditional court must consist of men and women pursuant to the goal of promoting the right of equality as contemplated in the Constitution. So it's a requirement now that there must be representation of women. Traditional courts must promote and protect the representation of and participation of women as parties and members thereof. And then to ensure that it's not just words in a law, there's a requirement for the Minister of Justice to put measures in place to promote the representation of women, because in some communities you might find women from a traditional perspective not wanting to participate in traditional courts. In other areas, you would have a woman as a traditional leader. And it's in fact for an annual report by the Minister of Justice to report on how women are being advanced. There's also provision for the Commission of Gender Equality to report to Parliament every year. So it's not just simply saying women must be promoted. Traditional courts must promote and protect the representation and participation of women. It's going a lot further than that. So Honorable Breitenbach completely ignores that. And yes, if Honorable Breitenbach wants us to continue with the situation we've got, of which there's no regulation because there's no statute. So I just sort of wanted to point that out. This is a difficult bill. I've said it before, this is a bill that nobody likes because it was a compromise bill. But given the different views, the different positions that people are coming from, they're not surprising if you've got a bill. I mean, I'd in fact said to the reference group, we are not going to produce a bill that everybody likes or anyone likes. The aim is to produce a bill that people can live with. But anyway, Chair, my appeal would be this issue has been going on for a long time. The issue before the committee is that to accept or reject the NCOP amendments, not all these other issues raised. Let me remind Honourable Ngema, not Honourable Ms. Ngema, that Parliament has twice certified this bill as being constitutional. And I think, I don't know if it was her opinion, but there was an opinion from the Parliamentary Law Advisors to this committee that the bill was constitutional, and I think it didn't require legal representation or an express opt-out clause. So, and the position we're in now is somebody, the opinion sought by Parliament, which needs to be considered, because we do respect the Constitution. We do agree that the traditional law must be subject to the Constitution. I think it is interesting that I don't have the text in front of me, but Advocate Masuku SC had talked about a quagmire produced by the Constitution. So ultimately, I'm sure it will have to be for the Constitutional Court, not individuals, to determine what is constitutional and what is not constitutional. So, Chair, I just wanted to say those in response to particularly Honourable Horne and Honourable Breitenbach. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Babam Samang. Honorable Msimang.
Now he can't switch his mic on.
Honorable Msimang.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Do you hear me now?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. I'll be very brief because we've been dealing with this bill for years now. In particular, I would like to support the proposal made by Honorable Horne, where he says that we need a dispute committee. I strongly feel that he's got his finger on the pulse when he says this. All the stakeholders should be included so that we can get unanimity. I also want to comment on the non-alignment with the Constitution, or that it is not amenable to transformation. If I look back to the KwaZulu Territorial Authority, where they took the code of Zulu law as it was then arranged by Sir Theophilus Chepstone, because the Zulu government took this code and they amended it radically. It still needs amendment, but they amended it radically in a way that was acceptable to the modern Zulus. So it's not true that it is not amenable to transformation. And then finally, I want to say, I commend Advocate Masugu for his report. I think he's touched on very many challenges in the present bill, especially when it comes to equality or harmony with the Constitution. So if we take that and study it very closely and find answers to the questions which he left unanswered, I think we are almost there, especially when we have the traditional leaders as member of the dispute committee, and also women, because they all feel that it gives power to men to actually turn them to slaves. And then also the traditional leaders themselves, because they live with this terrible suspicion that the government is all out to destroy the institution of traditional leaders. If they could sit at committees like where we are sitting, they would really see that there is a lot of support of traditional leadership, because as the deputy minister has pointed out, it's alive in the rural areas. People turn to it because it is the only option that is there. They know nothing about Roman Dutch law, and they feel that it answers to their problems. So all these stakeholders, if they are there, I think we are very much close to completion of our work. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Simang. Honorable Devote.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And good morning to everybody. Honorable Chair, just Honorable Janki. Honorable Janki has twice said that we should support the amendments made by the NCOP. And Honorable Jele has also supported that. So going forward, I would like to say that we support the NCOP amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Taylor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry for that. Chair, I wanted to clarify or maybe make our honorable members
aware that issues of women, for particularly Honorable Breitenbach, issues of women are covered by this bill. But firstly, before I come to that one, let me just say to Honorable Msimango, the issue that he's talking about, that people know nothing about this bill in those areas, rural areas and places of remote in our country. Maybe that issue, we cannot place it on this discussion today. My view is that it's supposed to be addressed by the issue of education. The department must come up with programs and campaigns that will assist our, not only on this issue, on this issue of this bill, but also in other bills that are out there. Indeed, there's sometimes lack of information in people accessing this information, knowing about their rights as to what is it that is applicable for them out there in terms of the law. But coming to this issue of women, we are, Honorable President Bach, accommodated. Yes, it might seem like with us, we are opportunity. We have opportunities which are more than those who are in the rural areas. But this bill allows both men and women to be represented and to represent themselves before a traditional court, as well as allows these men and these or women to be assisted by whoever they please. They will choose for themselves exactly, but they are allowed to present themselves, present their issues. It also requires that a traditional court must be open to all members of the community, including vulnerable persons and persons who are subject to discrimination due to their sexual orientation or gender identity. This clause resonates with the equality provision of the Constitution and the diversity requirement in the appointment of appointment of our judicial officers. What I'm trying to say here, Chairperson, is that we don't have to worry as women because the bill accommodates us. It is not an issue at the moment. I wanted to raise that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach. Is that an old hand or a new hand?
Old hand, sir.
Oh, no, thank you very much. No, I think we have had a very robust a debate on this bill. I think we have considered the legal opinion. Some have agreed with some aspect of the legal opinion, and there are some disagreement with some aspect of the legal opinion. But we must come back to what are we expected to do. There are only two responses that is expected from us. The first one, it's when we agree with the, is to say whether we agree with the recommendations from the NCOP or we don't. And then if we do, then the bill will go through and for president to accept or to return it back. Then if we don't, the suggestion by Honorable Msimang and Honorable Horn kicks in of the mediation committee. But having listened to all the honorable members, we are quite split, but the majority is of the view that this bill should go through and we should support the recommendations of the NCOP. I think the report would be written to reflect that, and we note that there is also a very strong opposition from some parties that are opposed to the passage of this bill. But based on the majority views, we will have a report that says this bill should go through and be debated in the National Assembly and accept the recommendations of the NCOP. Christine, how long will it take to draft the report?
Well, I basically got 3/4 of a report. I'm just not 100% sure how to reflect this last discussion, whether I should just, I think that's my only issue, but it can be ready by tomorrow. Perhaps you and I can have a 1-minute discussion later today, just to clarify.
So by tomorrow we can yeah. Adopt the report.
Yeah.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, members, for having a robust debate, but that is within the rules of Parliament, with a lot of respect for one another. I think it has been very impressive to have a robust disagreement without being rude to one another. I really commend you for that. Mr. Dupree, we come to you now.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Mr.
Chairman. Before you proceed, Mr. Dupree, let's start by apologizing for keeping you for so long. We first said you must come at 9:30, you said 11:00. And then it's nearly 12:10. But I'm also advised that you wanted to listen to the debate on the traditional court bill. But we really apologize for keeping you waiting for so long. You can take us through as to how far you were able to push with the land court bill.
Chair, sorry, just before Mr. Dupree comes in, will you allow me to excuse myself? I've got to attend another meeting physically.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Thank you for your attendance and your conversation. Yeah, excused.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. No need for apologies. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to ask the committee secretary to enable me to share my screen. And I would also like to ask the committee secretary to also allow Mr. Makudubede to also be able to share screen, just in case we are interrupted or kicked out of the meeting, then Mr. Makudubede could proceed further then. If I could just get confirmation that I've got the ability to share screen.
Yes, you can go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, we have prepared, and I appreciate that you are pressed for time. We have prepared a second working document. You will note that the grey highlighted areas, we've already explained those to the committee. Our new proposed amendments are coloured in yellow today. Don't know whether you want us to now strictly go clause by clause, or could I possibly just then focus on our yellow proposals? Cheers.
Yeah, no, I think focus on the yellow proposals.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, then I just need to get to our first highlighted area then. I apologize, might take a while. Right, with regard to the establishment of the court, questions were raised with regard to the whole issue of law and equity. However, if we look at the Restitution of Land Rights Act, for example, the Land Claims Court has been established as a court of law and equity, and that act has been in force for nearly 30 years now. The whole idea is to replace them, of course, the Land Claims Court with the Land Court. But what we would like to point out, or maybe to clarify, is that we say, we propose that we should say that the land court is hereby established as a court of law, and then in matters arising from the application of the Restitution of Land Rights Act or any other legislation expressly providing therefore as a court of law and equity. If this court is only established as a court of law, then the principle contained in the Restitution of Land Rights Act that the Land Claims Court is a court of law and equity will then be lost. I'm stepping down there, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to our next yellow proposal. Yes, Mr. Chair, this is an example. We received a number of comments that procedural matters in the court could not be prescribed by the minister. So what we are proposing here is wherever we get the term prescribed manner, then we must be careful and we will double check it again, Mr. Chair. There might be one or two that we might have missed, but or we might have been overzealous and proposed an amendment which should not actually be an amendment, but we're going to double check that. We propose then, wherever we get these type of provisions, that the it should not be prescribed by regulations, but rather be provided for in the rules. So the rules board for courts of law will then prepare those rules, especially then where procedural matters are involved. Chair, and while I'm going to the next yellow, I would just like to apologize. We haven't submitted the document to the committee yet. But at the conclusion of your meeting, I will submit it to your committee secretaries. It's just a small technical amendment there. I don't need to bore you with that detail. Mr. Chair, this is an issue that was raised in the committee previously, and I just need to maybe remind the members that previously we indicated that we would like to restrict hearsay evidence to claims in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act. But if I take you to the yellow at this stage, the proposal is that, and it's in reaction to the concern that was expressed with regard to the wide ambit of subclause 1, irrespective of the, if I may call it, proposed restriction introduced in 2A, is to maybe include, if I may call it, the restriction here, to say the court may, and then in the case of claims under the Restitution of Land Rights Act, admit evidence, including oral evidence, which it considers relevant and cogent to the matter being heard by it, whether or not such evidence would be admissible in any other court of law. I would just like to highlight this note that we've prepared here. We have decided to keep the grey proposal, but if we may call it a drafting note, the proposed amendment of subclause 2A to be removed if the proposed amendment of subclause 1 is accepted. Yes, this was the proposal by the Land Claims Court with regard to conferences. What we've also done, Mr. Chair, is we also just recapped or had a relook at the 15-page summary to make sure that we didn't miss something. The proposal here is, and the Land Claims Court is correct, it's better to refer to conferences only rather than pre-trial conferences, because although one cannot use the heading to a section to interpret your section, pre-trial conferences or pre-trial conference then implies that conferences can only take place before the trial. However, the proposed amendment that we've discussed with the committee last time is to provide for those conferences to take place at any stage during the proceedings in the court. Just a minute, sorry. My apologies, Chair. Then this is also a proposal that we picked up when we went through the 15-page document, is that the Land Claims Court also advised that it might be more appropriate to insert those words that at any stage after a dispute has been referred to the court, it becomes apparent that it would advance the finalization of the case if some or all of the disputes between the parties are then referred to mediation or arbitration. Yes, this was also a technical proposal that it would be more appropriate to indicate that in cases falling under paragraph B, that the court may, acting on its own accord, vary or rescind a decision, judgment or order. The paragraphs A and B should then be restricted to applications by the affected party. I don't think with regard to mediation, once again, procedural issues not to be prescribed by regulations, but rather be provided for in the rules. And there's another one. To a certain extent, we would like to regard it as technical amendments at this stage. The department conceded that it's not really appropriate for regulations to provide for these issues, and that it should rather be provided for in the rules. Also one of those technical amendments, Mr. Chair. There as well. The next one as well. But that's just tightening up the language or improving the language there, Mr. Chair. Yes, an arbitration award issued by an arbitrator is final and binding, and it may be enforced if made an order of the court as judgment in respect of which a writ may be issued. This is a technical issue that we've picked up, and we think it clarifies the provision there. Yes, this is also one proposal that me and my colleague would maybe just have another final look at, but at this stage it's proposed that subclause C should be deleted as well as then subclause 3. This is clarifying, Mr. Chair, that the Land Court of Appeal cannot ask the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then, of course, the Constitutional Court. So the proposed amendment here is to say that the Land Court of Appeal is, except for the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court, the final court of appeal in respect of all judgments or orders made by the court. The proposed amendment here, Mr. Chair, and we are looking at the composition of the Land Court of Appeal. We are aligning subparagraph C with the wording of the a similar clause earlier in the bill dealing with the composition of the Land Court. And paragraph C is also then in line with the provisions, relevant provisions of the Superior Court Act. Yes, and this is just to clarify that the judges of the Land Court of Appeal must be judges of the High Court or who may be judges of the Supreme Court of Appeal. That's just the a technical amendment reference to the specific section. Sorry, Jay, maybe I could mention, let me take you quickly to 351C, then you will see that it's so many other judges as may be prescribed, approved by the president. So it's just a cross-reference and an attempt to clarify who those appointees must be. Mr. Chair, this provision, we actually picked up the lacuna ourselves. It was not any recommendations that were made, but we realized while going through the bill again that we have got a provision. This provision only applies to the judge president and deputy judge president or judges of the Land Court, but we haven't got a similar provision dealing with the judges in the Land Court of Appeal. So it is a duplication of a provision already contained in the bill itself, but we think it's appropriate to have it here so that we ensure that all the judges of the Land Court and the Land Court of Appeal are then covered by the issue raised here. I apologize, Chair. I don't know. I think it might be nerves. Nervousness, Chair. Every time when one appears before the Portfolio Committee, extremely nervous. I don't know. My voice is going again. Might be psychological even.
Just relax. You have very friendly people here.
My apologies, Chair. Then to clarify that the Land Court of Appeal will not have exclusive jurisdiction, and in order to provide for appeals to the Supreme Court of Appeal or possibly even directly to the Constitutional Court, the removal of the word exclusive. That is just a technical amendment, Mr. Chair. The Western Cape government indicated that it's not necessary really to refer to the word contained or use the word contained. Mr. Chair, we have highlighted clause 46. And at this stage, it's proposed that paragraph B must be removed. However, we would like the committee to indulge us. Mr. Makudubeti and I would like to maybe reconsider and possibly even recommend to the committee that the whole of clause 46 might have to be deleted, because it doesn't, we would like to maybe just have a discussion on this one again before we give our final views to the committee. And clause 47 is then also just a technical amendment to the heading of clause 47. And then, if I remember correctly, it was also the Land Claims Court that recommended that judges of the Land Court of Appeals should not be taxing masters. So that provision is now being, or that recommendation is now being provided for. With regard to clause 49, that is also actually just a technical amendment, Mr. Chair. It's not really necessary under Chapter 6, our general provisions, to refer to both courts, because these matters will apply in any event to both of the courts being established. With regard to the transitional arrangements, Mr. Chair, the proposal was, this is also just tightening up of the wording, so to a large extent one could regard it as a technical amendment. We propose that the paragraph A must be inserted under subclause 2, because, and you will recall, we mentioned to you last Tuesday that the Land Claims Court recommended that provision should be made for the judges who are currently working as judges in the Land Claims Court. And this is the provision that aims to give effect to that. And it's largely along the lines as suggested by the Land Claims Court. Nothing to indicate with regard to clause 52. With regard to clause 53, and this is something that we will have to once again have a look at, but you will recall that these issues that are highlighted here must be removed, because it's no longer issues that must be provided for in the regulations, but rather in the rules of court. And this subclause here, we've got two options, and once again, we would like to discuss it further with each other, myself and Mr. Makudubeti. But this subclause 2 will in all likelihood be amended to refer to the rules board for courts of law. And then we've got two options. We can either retain it here and then maybe amend the heading to refer to regulations and rules, or it might be more appropriate to extract subclause 2 here and to draft a separate clause dealing with the issues that must be provided for in the rules. However, we need to interrogate this a bit more before we can come with a final recommendation to the committee. And it might be that we will have to go through the bill itself line by line to ensure that issues that must be provided for in the rules are then extracted, possibly as a separate clause. And then once again, this is only a technical amendment to remind ourselves that the proposed year of the Act should then be changed to the current year. Mr. Chair, that is what we can present to you at this stage. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tukri and Mr. Makuluweta, for the work done. Thank you very much. I think we have done a lot. Members, are there any questions or comments? Can you take the screen so that I can be able to see members? Can you take down the screen? I have Honorable Nivod Trocher, Honorable Werner Horn, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I would just like to ask Mr. Dupriere, when he emails the document, please could you include the highlights both in grey and in yellow so that we could see the changes that you made. If you could do that for us, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I would wanted also to request whether we can receive the updated document. And I've taken note of the fact that the department is still in respect of some matters, I want to say, having an in-house debate or discussion, which is all well and fine. In the meantime, however, I just want to again remind the department of some of the issues raised by members, which there was an undertaking that the department also will come back with an opinion and, if necessary, further amendments to the bill. So, yeah, appreciative of the fact that the Court of Law and Equity is now being regulated only in as far as it is currently a component of our legislative framework. I appreciate that. However, the other issue which colleagues would recall, which we've also raised, which I, through the way in which I could follow the presentation today, does not see advice or an end product yet, is the whole issue around who is to serve as arbiters and ultimately the specific question whether the members of the judiciary may also be entrusted with arbitration and mediation, and specifically, if that is the case, what other regulatory provisions have to be built into the bill to give proper effect to this. That's just on an initial reaction, Chair. Obviously, once we do receive the updated version of the bill, there might be other issues which we again want to raise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn, Honorable Chela.
Thank you very much, Chen. And also we want to thank Mr. Dupree for the work that he has done on this, as usual. But Chen, I was not part of the discussions. If you remember, it was when I was in the hospital. And then I'm not sure about other things. It's just two clarity questions. I hope he's not going to take you back, Chair, and to a new discussion. But are two things that I just want to know if this bill covers. The first question, Chair, is about, I want to make in two scenarios. The first one, there are families where, for example, the one, you know, where an uncle, for example, I want to make an example, an uncle raised this child and they all passed away. And then only maybe children that are left, but those children, even though they know about this, the previous place, the land where their parents were living, but they were removed one way or the other, but they really don't care. They don't care, but because of other circumstances, maybe, which are they are presented with, they are not able to, in fact, don't even know that they need to come here. Or maybe they pass, everybody passed on, but there's this one person who knows that that place my uncle used to own, and I don't, there's no one is claiming. How do you accommodate, is that person who knows about that information have a leg to go to the court and present or make a claim? Or, and in fact, I wanted to know also that what is it if there is something like that? Is there anything that that person has to present to the court? That is the first scenario, Che. The second one is about, there are these people who are staying in the farms for so many years. Their parents, their grandparents, everybody has always been there. And they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have a land when the grandchildren decide to chase them away and all that. Are those people maybe have rights that maybe they can go to the courts and present their matter and their matter be, I know in terms of property laws and all that, there might be some challenges when it comes to that. But I want to know, what is this court going to help? How is it going to help those people? Thank you, Tate. I don't want to take you back anything, but you can just explain to me if this bill covers all those people. If not, I'm fine. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just my one issue, Mr. Dupree. If you have the appeal court, the land appeal court, and the Supreme Court of Appeal, and the Constitutional Court, are we not creating too many layers which will make this process to be unaffordable? Because when a person has his matter adjudicated before or by the land court, from the cursory reading of the bill, that person can still have a right of appealing to the land appeal court, then to the Supreme Court of Appeal. So are we not creating too many layers that are going to be too costly for the litigants?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any other hands. I think you can respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask Mr. Makudubete to assist me, or rather to answer all the difficult questions. So I'm just going to answer the fairly easy ones today. I must get Mr. Makudubete to also experience the hot seat. With regard to the question raised regarding arbitration, we admit, Mr. Chair, there's a lot of work still to be done there. And possibly even a bit of research. So we had challenge of access to our virtual resources. So we will come back to the committee. We are also in the process, we're very near in finalizing a note that will be submitted to the committee. You will recall that we've indicated previously that those issues that have been raised will be addressed in the note, and they won't fall by the wayside. The question regarding families and the second or third generation that would like them to claim restitution in land rights. Maybe to explain it this way, the aim of the bill is only to replace the land claims court with the land court. The example used there is actually something that has been regulated in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act since 1994 and still is and will be even after the implementation of this bill. The first port of call is not necessarily in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act to the land court, but however to the structure created in terms of that act, and that is the Land Claims Commission, who then assists persons with their claims and investigate the claims, etc. With regard to persons staying on farms, once again, it's regulated in terms of the substantive law, and if I remember correctly, Mr. Makurubeti can correct me here if I'm not wrong, if I'm not right, and that is the, it's the Security of Tenure Act, but Mr. Makurubeti can confirm that for us. With regard to the creation of too many layers of appeal, Mr. Chair, that is something that we would also like to include possibly in our note for consideration by the committee. This is the second time that this question has been raised. It was also raised last week. If you compare, for example, high courts in civil cases, if you have a single judge hearing a matter as a court of first instance, the appeal is then usually to a full bench of the High Court, so that's appeal number one. You can then appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal if you're still aggrieved with the decision of the High Court of Appeal, if I might call it that for ease of reference. And then you can also then eventually appeal to the Constitutional Court. So those are three layers, and this is exactly what this bill does. It is fairly in line with appeals in the High Court. But we will get back to the committee in the note, and we will also address all the provisions concerned in this regard, statutory provisions, so that we can prove to the committee that the intention is not to create additional layers of appeal if you compare it to the High Court. Thank you, Chair. I don't know whether Mr. Makurubeti would like to add anything. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Makurubeti?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon to yourself and the honourable members. Chair, I must confess, Mr. Dupuy has answered all the questions, I must say. But in any event, just to remind the members of the committee that the Land Court is considered before as a baseline before a one judge, but the judge president is entitled perhaps to appoint two judges on the bench. But this will not be an ideal situation, but we have made a provision for that. Now, from the Land Court, the matter will go to the Land Court of Appeal, which will be presided over by a number of three judges. That's where the structure of the courts in terms of the bill, that's how the structure is. Now, with the introduction of the Supreme Court of Appeal, it will mean, therefore, that the matter from the Land Court of Appeal, which will have been presided over by three judges, will go to the Supreme Court of Appeal. Now, you'll remember, Chair, in terms of the Superior Court Act, as a starting point, the Supreme Court of Appeal is presided over by a number of five judges. However, the president of the Supreme Court of Appeal can decide the number of judges to be more than five or less than five. So to amplify what Mr. Dupree has mentioned, that is the structure that is similar to the current structures applicable in the high courts, because the matter will be heard by one judge as a starting point, and then it may go to the full bench of the High Court and then to the Supreme Court of Appeal. So with regards to the issue of the whether the bill accommodates the bringing of the or the bringing of the claim where the parents have passed on. Chair, Mr. Dupree has mentioned quite sufficiently so to say that this is a substantive matter. And I would classify that as a, let's say it falls under a restitution claim. The claim will be lodged with the commission, that is the Land Claims Commission, which will conduct the investigation in respect of that. Obviously, then I would not want to state how they conduct their investigations, but I will presume that they will want information that is necessary to enable them to come to a conclusion that there is a valid claim that can be processed here. And that is a matter of substantive law as contained in the Restitution Act. However, if the matter comes to court, that's when that clause come into play. That is clause 22 that talks to the hearsay admissibility of hearsay evidence. Obviously, we did mention here in the past that the court will admit hearsay evidence that is cogent and that is relevant to enable the court to come to a conclusion that will be fair in the circumstances of that case. Now, obviously, then the weight of the evidence that will be presented before the court will be of assistance to the court. However, in short, those claimants are not left in the woods. They will be covered in terms of approaching the court. That's all I can say in relation to this question, sir. Thank you very much, Chair.
So it will still be important, as Mr. Dupree has said, that you further apply yourselves to this issue of too many layers as it relates to access to justice to litigants. Because I think even Honorable Breitenbach would agree with me that even when we interview judges, this question comes now and again, even to a point where do we need to have this Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. I mean, so I think it's important that as we are beginning to create new courts, we really apply our mind to the question as to how do we ensure that access to justice is realized. Too many layers, do they assist in ensuring that access to justice is realized in as far as affordability is concerned?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, and I just go back to the questions. Apologies, I didn't answer the question about the document being forwarded to the committee members. Yes, I will submit the document today to the committee secretaries, and the highlights will be, they are actually on the document, so they will be visible, the grey highlights then the issues that we've discussed last week, and the yellow highlights the new proposed amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. It seems that Honourable Breitenbach has donated some of their dogs to you.
Chair, yes, and I apologize for that. It's a puppy Labrador, and at times it becomes a bit rough. The reason why I'm at home is that we need to have secure connection with the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, can I suggest that we allow them time to do the work that we have asked them to do, and they come back when we come back from recess? Will that be in order?
Yes,
Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dupuis, Mr. Magulubeta, thank you very much for the work done. Please circulate the document as agreed, and then we will see you in August when we come back from recess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may, Mr. Chair, with regard to, and it might be a difficult for you to answer now, but it will assist us in our preparations for the coming meetings then in August. Do you also plan to go back to the hate crimes bill, Chair?
Yes, in August, yes.
Thank you, Chief.
In fact, we plan to finalize both this bill and the hate speech bill. We have quite a number of other bills that have not yet been introduced, but that have got constitutional court deadlines, which we will have to also try and see how do we go about finalizing them. So, but these ones, they need to be finalized in the next term.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can you take down the, what is this thing, the slides? Yes, thank you very much. Members, we circulated a document to yourselves about the NCCS. If you remember, we did talk about it last year, that the minister has to appoint certain number of members in concurrence with parliament. That would be us and the NCOP. And I'm informed that the term of this NCCS is coming to an end very soon. So it is advisable that we would need to assist the process of ensuring that we speedily finalize the appointment in concurrence with the minister. So I'm not sure how members would suggest we handle this matter, because we've already circulated the CVs and the documents. Should we come back and discuss it tomorrow so that we can have a way forward from tomorrow? But how do you suggest we handle this one? Honorable Janji?
No, thank you, Chair. I have no problem if we do that tomorrow, except I wanted to say that it's one of the presentation that was presented to us on Friday. This presentation was fully presented to the subcommittee by the chair, who is Judge Mashile. Mm-hmm. It took us through the entire document and presentation, and there were no concerns or problems recorded by ourselves as a subcommittee on the issue. And this being the main committee, I have no problem that tomorrow we reflect on that and take a decision of endorsement or otherwise.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janji. Honorable Horn?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chair, I think we should quite possibly, just as a point of departure, again reflect on the responsibility of Parliament in respect of this matter. I'm not, and it's not necessarily to disagree with the Honourable Jayanti, although it is very easy to disagree with him. I want to suggest that we again just carefully look at the specific wording in the Act. We know this thing has a bit of a history and a context, in that in the past we were confronted with a decision that has been finalized and asked to endorse, etc. So maybe if our content advisors could maybe as a starting point tomorrow just also advise as to what they believe would be the proper way for us to go about this in order to discharge of our obligations properly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Horn. Because the Act says the minister must appoint in consultation, not after consultation with Parliament. So the issue would be, what will be the process? I think if I understand you, Honorable Horn, what
yes.
is the process of ensuring that in consultation is done properly?
Yes, if I may, I mean, and that's why I say I don't want to preempt it. We may take advice, but the way I understand it is that in consultation requires a meeting of the minds. And in that sense, I don't know whether merely giving us CVs and informing us that these are the choices I've made really would satisfy the in consultation requirement. But I don't want to be unnecessarily difficult. It is already so that the Honourable Jayanti has made adverse findings on my character, and Mr. De Pree is afraid of the committee as it is. So I'll downplay my possible objections to any process, but and request that we just consider that afresh tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Chance.
Yes, Chair. Chair, that's the reason I spoke first, that and I like the distinction. This is not after consultation. It's in consultation with the committee. And I support Honorable Horn. Let's get that reflection or advice. But the minister has already started that in consultation process. The fact that we had this presentation to us, it is for us tomorrow to have a view about the issue. I don't want to anticipate that discussion, but I would support that we do that so that we are tight on our processes. We have clarity on the kind of things that we do. I think it would be proper that we have a little bit of time tomorrow to have that shared with us. I think Honorable Horn, we can take other issues further to tomorrow. Don't want to get into that space now. So I normally agree with you, but when you show me Khokhajis, it's difficult to agree with you. Thank you, Chair.
thank you very much. So I think tomorrow's meeting is more about having a clear process, a clear legal process in place. And then once we agree on that process, then we will process the issue either tomorrow or soon thereafter, even if it's Friday. But we must have a process that would clearly satisfy the in-consultation process. So I think the committee secretariat and the content advisors, can you work on that so that you can lead us tomorrow? With virtual, I think it's important for people to indicate, because you might be speaking to people only to find out they're not here. Committee secretary. you will work on the general advice on a clear process tomorrow.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Members, and then tomorrow we'll also deal with the minutes so that we end the term properly. And we know that next week, Wednesday, is our in-house meeting where we will do a sort of a quarterly review of the term, and we plan the way forward. So I appeal to the committee secretariat and the content advisors to prepare for next week Wednesday as they did last time. It really assisted us, your preparations assisted us a lot last term, if you can do that even for this term. Members, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.